Station number 13123, Cyril Mount, Rail 6.
We're talking about the period of mechanisation.
Yeah.
How did the men, I mean, they were obviously upset about shooting the horses.
Yeah.
What about the whole idea of mechanisation? Was there much resistance amongst the men or amongst the officers?
No, I don't think so. I think we realised it was inevitable that, you know, if we're going to do any serious fighting, we'd have to, we couldn't go off to fight with horses. Although they did in the Dardanelles, I suppose, but, yeah. One of the big problems was very few people knew how to drive. And so we had this comical situation where they had these quads, large four-wheel drive vehicles for pulling the guns. And we had armoured cars with a very good, I think, a Rolls-Royce engine, I'm not quite sure, and chassis. But the body was built in India, and they had wooden floors, and only about that thick, about 3/4 inch thick wooden floor, and the sides were built of less than about a centimetre thick steel, which was soft steel, and which, if you fired at about 50 yards with a 303, the 303 actually penetrated it. It was such crappy steel. They were made in Tatanaga, and we called them. They were armoured observation vehicles, AOVs. And I remember talking to your guy who's in charge of the vehicles here ages ago, and he'd never heard of them. And I sent him a photograph of them. They're open top, and they're shaped like that, with a very good chassis, very good wheels, but the rest of it was absolute rubbish. So they were our armoured OPs, and we had these quads for pulling the guns. We still didn't have any guns other than the wooden wheeled ones.
So you'd now go in an armoured observation vehicle as part of the observation team as a
That's
signaller?
Right. Yes, as a signaller, wireless operator. Oh, we got wireless sets. Were
you still using the lamps at all, or were you
switching? We carried on using the lamps and heliographs, and until we got used to using these number 11 sets, a very old-fashioned set with a great big white handle in the middle. Well, we said over and clunk up, and then you press it down to send.
Would you send Morse on them with a wireless?
There was Morse and speech, but we tended to use Morse. Unless the speech was pretty ropey, you know, after about a mile it faded out. So you tended to use Morse over long distances. It was all very Fred Karno-ish, you know, a very funny army. And we used this Mao idea that each one teach one. As soon as one person had been taught to drive by somebody else, that the officers could drive. They were doing a lot of teaching, but as soon as one person had learned to drive sufficiently well, then he taught somebody else. And we had Chevs, 1500 weight Chevs. They were really nice, from America, with balloon tyres. And they were used as wireless trucks, apart from the OP vehicles. There was only one OP vehicle to each troop.
And were you attached, were you on the OP vehicle, or would you take it in turns?
We tended to take it in turns as to whether you were a gun position operator or an OP operator.
So the gun position would be in the Chevrolet? The wireless.
In the gun position, it would be in the Chev, yes, and the OP would be in the armoured observation vehicle.
Would you they'd still run what? So that the routine would be that the armoured car or whatever, armoured observation vehicle,
yeah,
would go out and establish radio wireless contact,
yes,
and then they'd run the line out still.
They'd still put a line on it, yes, even in the desert we did that. And the idea of an armoured vehicle was that they could actually go with an armoured regiment. They could go with a squadron of armoured cars or light tanks. And in fact, this did happen several times in the desert, and it was very scary because they were a hell of a lot better armoured than we were.
We'll be on. So, yeah. But they'd be. You'd be going out to establish communication.
You'd go, and
then the lines would be running.
You were there as an observation officer. If they wanted you to bring fire down on a particular point, that was your job.
Would they always run a line out after you, or would that?
Well,
be
only if the position became static. Yeah. Otherwise, you're working by radio all the time.
Did you take to the radios, the wirelesses, or whatever?
Did
you have to learn maintenance and repair and the theory of it, or was
it just
a box?
Yes. You had to use a certain amount of knowledge that A lot of training went on about not only operating but maintenance and battery charging and all the various things you had to do. We had these little chore horses, petrol driven things for charging the batteries.
So that was one side. Did you learn to drive yourself?
I learned to drive, yes. Somebody taught me to drive, and that's the only driving instruction I've ever had. And I've got a full license to drive everything, including tanks and track laying vehicles.
Did you find it difficult to learn to drive, or were you a natural?
No, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed this shed. We learnt on the sheds, I remember. And what happened then?
Would you ever use your driving? I mean, would you drive the armoured observation vehicle or the shell? Or would there be drivers to do
that? No, they were quite sort of tricky to drive, because you're driving you're looking through a slit. And, there were specialist drivers for the...
Would you take a turn on the Chev, though?
Oh, yes, yeah.
When you were on that side of it?
Yeah. You were literally a driver-operator.
So you mechanised,
we were then mechanised, yeah, and then out of...
And when was that,
was during the summer. There was no hill station malarkey then. Everybody was working flat out. And then in...
Was that 41 or...?
That was 41, yes. And then in July 41, we were told we were going to move. And I've forgotten the exact date. It was very early in August. We... had to hand everything into stores. Everything went except a bedding roll with a ground sheet round it and rope and kit bags. All our boxes of goodies that we'd collected. Everybody had tin boxes where they'd been buying things, you know, thinking one day we're going to go home to Blighty with the tin boxes on.
What happened to them?
Well, they were all sort of carefully painted with our name, rank, number, and unit, and we were told that they would be sent back to England, or first of all they'd go to base depot in the Middle East, and then they'd be sent back to England, and no need to worry. Okay. And that included kit bags, everything. So we were left with small packs, big packs, and a bedding roll.
Did they go back? I mean, did you ever get your box?
I don't know anybody who ever got their gear. I think once they got to Egypt, that was it.
So you only had... You didn't have very little left.
We had just the basic necessities, yeah.
What happened next?
Then, well, I can remember very clearly that the night before we left, and trained, we had to sleep on the floor. On these, so the durry, a durry is one of those Indian rugs, which is very useful. We had durry, we were allowed to keep those, and a couple of blankets, and your greatcoat for a pillow, and... They were rolled up, and but people sort of had to put them down on the coal flagged stones of the bungalow. But we, about five of us, went out that night, and we went down to the city, and we bought a bottle of Indian whiskey each, and we just sat on a wooden veranda of one of the shops that was still open, you know, about 9 o'clock at night, and drank ourselves absolutely stupid. And we tried to walk back, singing, holding each other up, and we couldn't. We fell down. We literally fell. And we were on our hands and knees on this hot tarmac, dusty road. And we must have crawled back to the barracks with this appallingly pissed sort of state. A Tonga came. A Tonga was a two-wheeled Gary, you know, with one horse, came along. And I think he picked two or three people up. We loaded them onto that and told him where to take them. And I think we staggered back ourselves, you know, part crawling, then standing up, and then falling down again. It was disgusting because we're so full of this awful rotgut whiskey that I don't remember anything about leaving. We got on a train, and the first thing I remember was on a boat, and the boat was called the SS Neuralia, and it left Bombay. And I think it was probably the morning after we'd sailed when I finally sort of came round. And it wasn't seasickness. I was just throwing up green bile, you know, it was awful. And all the guns and everything was on board. Our whole battery was on board this SS Neuralia. And we kept looking at the sun to see which way we were going. We were sailing out from Bombay, and everybody was convinced we were going to Singapore. And then it must have come over on the radio that the Japs had invaded. Whether we were going to Singapore or not, I'll never know. That part of it. I looked in the regimental diaries, but there's bugger all, they're so badly written. There's nothing there. So whatever it was, we turned right and we went up the Gulf. And this was August, and it was very, very hot. And we landed in Basra, and we went to a camp which had been a First World War camp, and these EPIP tents were erected. And we just sort of, we trained again there in this foul, total evil place, you know, but there was just like a perpetual shitstorm of gravel flying through the air about 90 miles an hour all the time. I pity those people who went to the Gulf. I kept thinking of that, and then the Gulf War was on. And we didn't know what the hell was happening. Nobody told us what was going on. There had been some action previously when they rooted out Rashid Ali, who'd taken over a Banya aerodrome up near Baghdad, but that had all been squashed. So we didn't know what we were there for. And then I got a septic toe, and I had to go into this tent, this medical tent, and lie there while he put a local injection in, and he took my toenail off and allowed me to watch him taking my toenail off and all the pus squirting out of this big fat septic toe. So I then had to cut a hole in a gym shoe, and I went into action. The next day we went over a bridge at Kerem Shah that the engineers had put up, and we invaded Iran. And I was driving a Chev, a K truck, which is the battery captain's truck, which is mainly he's in charge of the wagon line and the B echelon, you know, the administration bit. So all the food lorries, we had three tonners as well. They came up trundling behind. And I was a driver operator in this K truck with a great big fat toe with bandages sticking out of my gym shoe. And we just went right up this long river. Occasionally, we came to a fort. The guns dropped into action, and then I think they lobbed a few rounds over. And the next minute, all these little creatures came running out, waving towels and handkerchiefs and flags, and they surrendered very quickly. Anyway, these Iranians, and we just trundled on until we came to this big town, Ahwaz, halted on the river.
Did you know who you were fighting or what was going on or anything?
We knew that it was Persia, as it was called then. We knew we'd invaded Persia, and it was all very comical. I mean, some of the lads actually were getting the equipment off these people that I didn't bother with. They had sort of crude bandoliers that looked like they'd been made of goat skin with bullets, you know, crude sort of belts and what looked like muskets. It was very sad because I don't think any. Oh yes, there was one occasion when we were all advancing in a long line across this crackling mud, and we'd gone forward with the Gurkhas, who had similar trucks, 1500 weight of some sorts, with Brens mounted, and they were only kids. They came running out with waving their white, you know, surrender things. And these bloody Gurkhas went roaring towards them with the Brens, opening up with the Brens. And then my battery captain, John Evans Lawrence, was killed later on. He was driving at that time, that's right. And he just swooped right over in front of these Gurkhas and screamed, "You horrible little bastard, leave them alone. Can't you, don't you understand what a white flag means?" And he gave them hell, you know, because I don't know where their own officers were. But they just got excited, and I don't know if they killed or hit anybody, but that was the only real big incident, apart from twice the guns dropped into action and just made a few bangs and frightened them.
Did you know what the targets were, or were you not at the OP?
I think they bracketed the fort. They were little sort of clay forts, mud forts, and they dropped one in front and one on the other side to let them know that we had them. Bracketed. But that was all. Yeah, it was comical, really.
And they'd surrender then.
And then they'd all run out. Yes.
And you were with the battery captain during.
Yes. This. Yeah. And the terrain was absolutely like a billiard table covered with cracks about 2 inches wide, and it's This is apparently where the big flood happened, you know, when Noah was building his ark. I don't think anybody had ever been over this ground before, because it was just, all you could hear was the crackle of this mud as you raced over, you know, about 40, 50 miles an hour. It's quite an experience. Quite a long distance as well, with nothing in between us and this place I was. Well, we halted there, and the Gurkhas were just downriver from us, and we were going to have it was a muddy river, but everybody was so hot and dirty, we were going to have a dip. And then we heard this screaming, and there was a whole gang of Gurkhas sort of on the bank pulling at something. So we raced over to see what it was, and one of the lot had gone in, and most of his legs had disappeared. The river was rotten with piranhas, and he'd been more or less eaten alive, you know, and he was bleeding, and whether he died or not, I don't know, but I actually think he did, because he was in a hell of a state. He'd gone in naked as well, you know, so that was the biggest event there. We stayed there for over a month. Oh, we sent a patrol up with the Gurkhas and I think a couple of the armoured cars, yes, went up to one of the oil companies had been surrounded. They were still, and this was in the hills. And I know I must have gone with them, but I don't remember anything about it. But I remember going up this mountain road, and it was getting more and more green and beautiful and cooler, and little streams. It was sort of like Omar Khayyam country. Flowers blooming at the side of these little streams. You know, it was so different from the desert. But I can't remember what happened after that. I don't remember. There were families up there. There were oil company families that had been surrounded by these people. Because there were a lot of German agents in. This is why we went in, yes. It was rotten with German agents who were, you know, obviously hoping for a takeover. And the same thing had happened in Iraq with Rashid Ali. So the object of the exercise, I suppose, was to root out the German agents.
Was were you getting things like basic rations and everything up all right during the month?
It was very, very, very basic. Yeah, I mean, I remember the there was one 3-tonner that was packed with wood, and it was for burning. We had the Punjab rifle. Yeah, we had a secret, we had the Gurkha regiment, and this 3-tonner, it was packed with wood, it was for burning these people when they got killed. The Indian rations were the staple thing. You know, we got flour and dal and chickpeas, that sort of thing. And it was basically for them, because we were the only white regiment with it was 8th Indian Division, by the way. So we got these awful cigarettes, Victory V cigarettes.
What was awful about them?
Well, they were full of weevils that you had to. There were holes in them, like woodworm holes, and you had to find bits of paper and stick them on the holes, wet them, stick them on the holes, and then when you smoked the thing, it crackled because all the weevils inside were popping, cracking. And we didn't get any decent cigarettes. Oh, beedies. We could have had beedies. Some people actually started smoking. The beedies are little. Hand-wrapped brown, it's just leaf, tobacco leaf, and they're pretty awful. They are the things that the Indian, the boot boys, our bearers, used to smoke on the veranda in India, and used to throw boots at them. And they
actually, I forgot to mention the bearers, that you had servants, didn't you?
Well, we shared a boy, well, we used to call them boys, that's right, between about 3 or 4 of us, and he'd get about a couple of rupees each from us.
What would he do for you?
And he would clean boots, he would take all the washing to the dhobi, and make your bed, and then he'd make sure the sweeper came and swept around your bed. And they were nice, devoted people, we quite liked them, you know.
You treated them all right then?
But, yeah. But we wouldn't let them smoke their beedies on the veranda.
And you didn't take them with you, of course, when you went to Russia?
No. We took some Indian cooks, the Babajis, with us. But they seemed to disappear after we got to Egypt. I don't know, they must have gone back.
Now, after a month then, at Awas, what happened then?
Somebody else went up, another party went out to Tehran and contacted the Russians. I don't know why, there's some officers, and I don't know what that was about. But I remember that being talked about. We then came back and we went to another horrible place in Iraq called Kirkuk, where there were two flares burning on the, on these, this ridge of small mountains called Abednego, Meshach, something on Abednego. They were the biblical characters. They had names, yeah, these great oil flares, and the whole place stank of rotten eggs, you know, sort of
And when would you get
hydrogen.
There? Would that be September or...?
That would be October.
October.
Yeah. So, you know, we'd put in months in a very unpleasant, dusty, dirty conditions in Awas, and then to Kirkuk, and then from Kirkuk we went.
What were you doing at Kirkuk? Just
nothing that I can remember. We, you know, we just made camp, and it started to rain. It was muddy, and all I can remember was mud and sulfurated hydrogen stink of, you know, rotten eggs.
The snows hadn't started, because the winters are terrible there.
No, but the snow did start with a vengeance. We went up from there to Mosul in November, and immediately started digging. Right, and we went beyond Mosul to a place called Bukak, a very small place with a water point, I remember that. And that's one of the first drawings I did. No, I did some drawings in Awas, that's right, and they got lost. But I did some drawings there, and because I was a good drawer, they gave me a job while everybody else was digging gun pits. I had to go onto this windy sort of hillside and draw panoramas. We then marked the targets, but I had to sort of emphasize certain salient points, like an outcrop of rocks or a sort of oak or something on the hillside, and these were numbered as targets, and then they were registered as targets. And I realized afterwards we were shooting into Turkey. Nobody seems to complain. There was no habitation. There was just this great big river with thousands of quail that would settle, which people went out to try and shoot. But then the snow came, and I still had to go out making these drawings with the mittens, with the gloves and the fingertips cut off. And so they had a complete sort of almost a 190-degree panorama which fitted together. And most the main targets were recorded by shooting.
That's normally the specialists that do that, you know. But that was a special job.
It's a specialist job of an OP assistant, an observation post assistant, OPAC.
Yeah, but you weren't one of those. You were
no, I wasn't one of those. But when I'd drawn the panoramas, an officer came up with me, an OP officer, and he directed the fire. And so we had £25 by then. Yes, we had £25 to go up to Awas.
That's when you got them, was it?
Yeah, we got them in India. We left with them, yeah. And this guy, this officer, recorded all these targets and put the range and the angle of sight on the panorama. Because we were fully expecting the Germans to do a right hook through Turkey. And this is what we realised then what we were there for. And I don't think we'd have stood an earthly if they had come. But we'd recorded all these points anyway, so if their tanks had appeared around that valley, we'd have plastered them. And it snowed, and I guess the snow was about 4 feet deep. And we were very, very pissed off. Everybody was in a state of mutiny because they had two pairs of long johns on and KD trousers. We had no serge. We had no ordinary serge clothes. We left India with khaki drill trousers. And we had our greatcoats. And these were two pairs of KDs, two pairs of long johns, tucked into two pairs of socks, if you could get them over your boots. And everybody was sodden and dirty, and lice started to appear. And we were living in dugout this deep, about 5 feet deep in the earth. And there was a plentiful supply of charcoal. They issued charcoal. And these little tin sigris, they're called, they were Indian issue. But it's a miracle nobody died, because down in the, with a 180-pound tent over the top, you see. And the outside, the snow was 4 feet deep. And It was so bloody cold and miserable. You know, the people were digging all day. They were really in a state of mutiny. And we come back, and the main meal was that the Gurkhas would behead these sheep that they were buying from the locals. And our own cooks had to skin the sheep. So we'd come back every night to the same meal, these great big cauldrons, heated with oil blowers, turnips and mutton. And there was always, without fail, you'd find a piece of wool in your stew. And people don't believe this. So, you know, people are getting really fed up with this situation.
Were there any infantry in the area?
Only Indian infantry, yeah.
Still?
But then we went back.
When they were that fed up, did it show itself at all? Or was it just grumbling?
Oh, there was a lot of sort of singing Balsi songs as they went out in the three tunners to do the digging, you know, digging gun pits. They were digging one lot of gun pits and then they go forward and dig another lot, you know. And I felt at the time, looking back, I felt that they were giving them gun pits to dig to keep everybody quiet because nobody knew what was happening. We were waiting for orders, literally.
Did the officers ignore the songs?
I think they were feeling as pissed off as we were. I remember the Christmas, there was a party went off to try and find something different, and they got lost. But they met some Kurds, I think, and they swapped cigarettes and something. And they got some arak. Oh, we know we could go into Mosul, but then the track between us and Mosul became impassable. So they had these quads with the long cables on either side. They're forward drive, winching the three tunnels through this mud, which is about 3 foot deep. You know. Occasionally a passion wagon, as they call it, where it was allowed to go into Mosul for the day, and there you could buy arak, which is like ouzo, you know, and a cheap wine called Hanbu wine. So that eased the situation a little bit, I think. But food was very... Everybody's hungry all the time. There was nothing... There were no nibbles of any sort, no chocolate or anything like that, you know. And I think that's what was making everybody really pissed off. But then came January...
It's 42,
and we then moved.
So you were there about 2 months at Mosul.
Yeah.
And a month at...
All through that really bad snow. It was very, very cold. It was on the Turkish frontier, and as I say, we were shooting into Turkey.
Not at targets.
Oh, no, we were registering targets, yeah. So we went back to a place and a funny name, started with a Q, with three letters. Q something, a very strange name. And we started training then. Okay, and calibrating the guns, and this new wireless sets came from somewhere.
This is still in Iraq, though.
This is still in Iraq. And then...
Which wireless sets were they?
We then got 19 sets, yeah. And we had to retrain on those.
How were they better? Or worse?
Oh, much better, yeah. I don't know where the old 11 sets... I think the 11 sets were pre-war jobs. But we'd never seen them, you know. But the 19 sets, they could have been American, I don't know.
In what way were they better?
Oh, they were... longer range, more up-to-date sort of, you know, headphones, rather like tank headphones. The other headphones were just little plastic things, you know, Bakelite, and the microphones on the 11 set were very primitive, whereas, you know, it was just before you had to knock up a lever up and down on the 11 set, whereas the 19 set you just press the pistol switch and set over.